supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And the family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. For those of you listening who are over 40 years old, you have probably experienced some form of trauma in your life. It's a doctor saying it's malignant, or a spouse saying, I can't do this anymore. A child born with a disability. Almost all of us have experienced trauma, and we know about the trauma nations experience. War, returning soldiers, 9/11, natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina. We all know about trauma, and most have experienced it. Yet, some people become mired down in it, develop PTSD, never seem to get past the trauma, while others not only survive, but find a way to make meaning out of the tragedy, and their lives are actually transformed for the better. Today on Voices in the Family, we're going to talk about resilience. What it is it genetic? Can it be learned? If so, how so? And can we teach it to our children? My guests are Dr. B. Hollander Goldfein. She's the director of postgraduate training in marriage and family therapy at the Council for Relationships. She's also director of the Transcending Trauma Project, and we're going to hear more about that as we go on. Be welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm also joined by Tamar Chansky. He's director and founder of the Children's Center for OCD and Anxiety, author of Freeing Your Child from Negative Thinking, Powerful Practical Strategies to Build a Lifetime of Resilience, Flexibility, and Happiness. Tamar, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And if you want to join our conversation about resilience, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. If you've experienced trauma and have either gotten stuck and can't get past it, or you have and it's transformed your life for the better, give us a call. 888-477-9499. B, let me start with you. How do you define resilience?
Well, I think resilience is the capacity after dealing with adversity, challenge, difficulty, or trauma. It's the ability to go on, to rebuild your life, to continue to live in the way that you chose to before, that fills the values and feels productive and constructive.
Fair enough to say return to baseline?
Return to baseline, yes. But also for many people, it means more. Hmm. The baseline is no longer the same because the person is challenged to look at their life differently, to reorder their priorities, and to live in a way that's sometimes more determined, more intentional.
New normal.
Right.
Tamar?
Yeah, I agree with that, and we were talking before the show about maybe some of the differences in populations that B and I see, but I think that where a lot of families may encounter more everyday adversities and kids experience those, that resilience is not getting stuck with the story of that this is a forever thing, whatever that event was, and being able to move beyond that.
There are several perspectives on resilience. B, you've talked about the family resilience perspective. What is that?
Well, I think it's essentially paralleling the development in mental health, where for a long time mental health would focus on the individual. And with the growth of the marriage and family therapy movement and systemic theory, the sense is individuals are never alone. They're always in the context of their significant relationships, be it in childhood with their family of origin, being in adulthood with their nuclear families and their friendship circles. So it's, we think that it's really impossible to understand the individual without the context of the family. The family influences the individual and vice versa.
You talked about, in an article you sent me, a family belief system. So is that kind of a story a family tells themselves about the world, themselves, how they fit in it?
Yes, it's about can be about religious faith. It could be the explanation of life. What is life at all, is all about? It's about self and what self can be. It's about the meaning of family and connection of relationships, and it's about, you know, coping with life's demands and encountering difficulty and how you would go about doing that.
So, give us an example of a family belief system, because it's more than just optimistic or pessimistic families, or is it?
Optimism and pessimism would be sort of an overall category for a belief system defined in certain ways, but it's how you go about it. So an example might be, you know, we'll handle it, we can take care of it, there's no problem that we can't deal with, we just have to think about it and plan. Be it about whether if the family's challenged or the individuals are challenged. Or you can do it, or we'll figure it out, or there's always a solution.
I grew up in a family, third generation in this country, but the message in the family was the world can be pretty tough, mm-hmm. and you have to be prepared for tough, and you've got to watch yourself and don't be too vulnerable and so on and so forth. Now, I wonder then how much of that comes from Russia, where it all got started, and how much of it is genetic, is a family story, and partly, in part, genetic.
Right. Well, I wouldn't put that kind of belief on the level of genetics. I would put certain qualities in terms of handling life on the genetic level. But I think you're right. I think it comes from the family experience of challenge, dislocation, and threats that they encountered, most probably to their lives, and how you transition to the new country. The issue is, did they let you out the door or they didn't let you out the door? If they have that belief, which is based in reality, that it's tough out there, do they train you to go out there and live and fulfill yourself, or do they keep you home in a state of fear and threat? That's the difference in terms of how a belief gets translated into the quality of people's lives.
I want to talk to you about some of these numbers that I've been reading about resilience and trauma. One of the numbers I read that I put out in the opening billboard was somewhere around a third of people experience who've been through trauma experience PTSD and are symptomatic. And that says something about the other two-thirds who don't. So it's really a minority who experienced symptoms of trauma. Tamar, can you say something about that group?
And I think the number for children is a little bit lower, that I believe it's about 1 in 4 will experience PTSD. But you're talking about the resilient group, Dan?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, some of the things that Bea was mentioning, that if you grow up with a fairly rigid mindset that things need to be a certain way, when they don't go that way, you're going to get really thrown off track. And it may be really difficult to ever overcome that. But on the other hand, if you grow up, you know, either your parents modeling this or some important person modeling this in your life, that there are going to be difficult times that are going to feel overwhelming at first, but that feeling does not remain. There are things that you can do to change your experience of that trauma.
B?
I would say also that it's the two-thirds that you report who do not develop PTSD. that really inspired the work of the Transcending Trauma Project, because most of the literature in the up until the early 80s was dealing with only the pathological response to trauma. And no one was paying attention to the fact that there was enormous variability in the group and a lot of individual differences. And at that time, we committed ourselves to understanding not just the impact of trauma, but the process of coping and adaptation, which would describe the other two-thirds who went on to live productive lives.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Lisa on the line. Lisa, hi. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
Well, this is a topic that has always been of great interest to me. I was in a fire when I was 4 years old. I'm 46 now, and I was very badly burned and had, you know, I don't know, 30 operations or something like that. And I was far away from my family and had, you know, I won't say the best level of support system coming to me. And yet my brother, who didn't go through any of that, who was a lovely, lovely boy and really very gifted, took his life when he was 19. And so here I am. Now I'm in my 40s. I have a family. I'm a psychologist, and I'm doing pretty darn well. And I've never been able to figure out where that comes from. It doesn't feel like anything consciously that I've done. It has felt more like a genetic gift.
You mean your resilience?
Yes.
You brought up the issue of your brother. Are you suggesting that part of the reason he took his life was because of the trauma of the fire?
No, I don't believe it was. I think he had his own depressive illness and things that he was contending with. I guess I bring up the issue of my brother just because it's sort of the opposite of resilience of, in terms, you know, tragically, in terms of what happened to him. And if you were to look at the two of us on paper, if you were going to pick somebody who wouldn't make it, you'd think it would be me.
Yeah, you would on the surface, but maybe not as we look beneath the surface. What are your thoughts about now? Here's this variability between siblings.
Right. You know, as a therapist, I train myself to not jump to conclusions, but to always probe for the client's story, the person's story of his or her life, and to understand it really well. So it's hard to react to just these facts, but the questions I would ask, as you mentioned, your brother experienced depression. So I would like to understand that in terms of the life course and to what extent it was biological and to what extent it was treated, but also in terms of your experience in the fire. You said you didn't have that much support. I would want to know a lot more about that. What support did you get? How did you experience your recovery? Where were you? Who were around you? Was there a special person, perhaps not a family member, but was there a special person in your life who offered you something connecting to hold on to that could then affirm you?
I got to stop you there because I want Lisa to answer some of those questions.
Okay.
Go on.
Yeah, I was 200 miles away from my family receiving my hospital care because it was the best hospital care we could get. And I saw my parents on the weekends, but I had a wonderful surgeon who I still keep in touch with to this day. He's in his 80s now. And he, you know, you don't necessarily think your Harvard surgeon is going to be particularly connected, but he was very connected. And I always felt that he was going to make sure I was okay.
Well, what was your opening thing? You didn't have that much support? Was that your opening comment?
Well, I think I meant family support, the way you traditionally think of it, yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the things we're going to hear as the show unfolds is that people find their support where they need it. I also want to comment and get maybe be in Tamar's reaction. I've got a lot of personal interest in resilience, and I've never studied it per se other than to read the literature, but I interview a lot of people who are resilient, and the one theme I find that comes up over and over again is just what you're saying, Lisa. Everyone says there was a moment in my life when I needed help and help was there, and it took a dozen different forms or more, but what I needed was right there in the form of another human right when I needed it. Lisa, I'm glad you had that surgeon in your life. I'm glad you're still in touch with him. Take care.
I mean, research on children at risk, looking at who makes it and who doesn't, will talk about the person in the system that takes on this child in a caring and loving way, having a profound impact on that child's development.
And there's lots of ways of defining what care really means. I want to turn to you, Tamar. Parents who are caring for their children by being overprotective, by trying to help them avoid any adversity or trying to minimize the impact of adversity, are not necessarily caring for them in a way that's necessarily healthy, although that's all of our instincts.
Exactly, right. It's not sustainable, this overparenting thing. But it's not helpful to the child either. And the way that I think about it is that there's a lot of uncertainty now, and I think we've been sort of in a decade or more of anxiety, and that parents have absorbed that, and we see that in their parenting. But it doesn't help to scurry and sort of add more activities for our kids. I mean, it may be enriching, but really what the issue is coming down to finding, helping the child see what he or she has within him or herself to bring to the situation. A lot of building resiliency is very mundane. I'm going to put that out there, that when you don't know what to do for dinner or your child's forgotten their math book, that's such a great opportunity to bring out the resilience in your child by simply asking for their input. That's where it starts every day.
The question I have, and I'll turn to you, Bea, is if you are a parent and your family story is one of anxiety, that if my child forgets their math book or if I forget my assignment at work, it feels catastrophic. So if that's the message we carry inside, we carry that anxiety that Tamar referred to, you know, how can we teach our children anything other?
Well, I think that's correct, and I think Tamar has worked a great deal on that in terms of her clinical work and writing. In the experience of the Transcending Trauma Project, which is about Holocaust survivor families, three generations of them, survivors have certainly been through what can only be called horrific beyond words. And yet, many of them come out of the experience able to marry, to make connection with their spouse, to then have children, and to raise them in a constructive environment. Now, what goes into that? Part of what goes into that is the qualitative family relationships that they experience in their family of origin. It's like a template inside that when all is lost and you have to put the first step forward, what do you rely on? And you rely on what you know and what built your foundation. And in terms of raising children, you know, part of it is awareness, a sort of a self-reflective functioning where you are aware that even though you bear anxiety because of what you experienced, what is it that my child needs? And I will stretch to give my child what my child needs to be okay, even though last night I was up with nightmares.
Yeah, that's hard to do because internal anxiety really demands attention, and internal anxiety really clouds your eyes. It's hard to see other when the noise inside is pretty loud. I mean, Right. We all know that.
Right, except that we did find it. We did find that for survivors who have the pain inside, with effort, they could see the needs of their children.
All right, so given that, let's take a short break. I want to come back and talk about the Transcending Trauma Project. We're also going to bring in Roberta Green, who's chair of gerontology at the University of Texas in Austin, and she specializes in resilience. That's what we're talking about today on Voices in the Family, is resilience, what it is, how it can be taught, and how it can be, I guess, interfered with, too. My guests are Tamar Chansky, who's a psychologist, director, and founder of the Children's Center for OCD an anxiety-written three books on anxiety and resilience, tomorrow. I'm also joined by Dr. B. Hollander Goldfein. She's director of postgraduate training in marriage and family therapy at the Council for Relationships. And she's the director of the project we're going to hear more about after our break, the Transcending Trauma Project. Our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
The Penn Program for Stress Management supports WHYY and sponsors a three-day event, February 6th through 8th, exploring mindfulness and meditation as tools for teaching and learning. Featuring a public lecture by Jon Kabat-Zinn, the founder of Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, followed by an interview with Dr. Dan Gottlieb of WHYY's Voices in the Family. Full details at pennhealth.com/stress or 215-615-2775.
Keeping up with the news has never been more important or more expensive. That's why WHYY is asking for your tax-deductible gift as this year comes to a close. The money you give will pay for the NPR news you use next year. If you received a letter from WHYY asking for your support, please mail your check today or give online at whyy.org. That's whyy.org. Thanks.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Resilience is what we're talking about, what it means, why some people have it, and why others don't. My guests are Tamar Chansky, director and founder of the Children's Center for OCD and Anxiety. He's written three books on children's anxiety and resilience. B. Hollander Goldfein is director of postgraduate training in marriage and family therapy at the Council for Relationships. I'm director of the Transcending Trauma Project. And joining us now on the phone is Roberta Green, chair of gerontology at the University of Texas in Austin. She's the author of Resilience, an Integrated Approach to Practice, Policy, and Research. Roberta, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
One of your findings in your research with both Holocaust survivors and emergency workers is that people have a natural tendency to heal. How did you find that in your research?
Well, we talked to a number of people in our Holocaust projects who we asked directly how they thought they had coped with such a horrific event. And they began describing things that they, in quotes, just did, like look for family members, or look for food, or try to just make it through each day, or be helped by another person that was there at a fortuitous time. And so it's something that people tend to describe as just happening. But we know that it's triggered by the stress and the crisis, and that resilience can emerge in most anyone.
Roberta, there's a beautiful line in a poem comparing the human spirit to a flower, and it said, just as sure as a flower is drawn to the sun, it is the nature of the human spirit to seek wholeness. So what interferes with that? If it's in there for all of us, then what interferes with it?
Well, I see it as not a complete either-or property or characteristic that people have, that it can flower in anyone given the right context and help. Sometimes it happens when we're doing our clinical work with someone. It may happen because of the support system or meeting a new friend. Many things can trigger the emergence of resilience, I believe.
Hmm. When we spoke to you earlier last week, you cited a classic study by Robert Coles when he looked at children who survived the Cambodian Civil War. What was his key finding?
His key finding was about mothers, that children who felt that their mothers were there for them did the best, that weren't orphaned or separated from their mother figure. And the other research that we have really supports that if we have that mothering or mentoring or nurturing figure, maybe like the person who called in, the surgeon was acting in that role.
Yeah, exactly. I would also imagine, B, that's consistent with your findings.
Yes, that it's about, again, I call it the same term, you know, the quality of relationships in people's lives that keep them connected, which is to some extent the purpose to go on, the meaning to go on, to live for oneself and to help other people in the situation.
Roberta, one aspect of your work that's particularly interesting to me is studying how resilience happens over the lifespan. Tell us about that. It's not a static phenomenon.
I think of it as a process over time. You're absolutely right that when we're in our family of origin, there are certain protective factors and things that contribute to that adaptation. We heard about some of those earlier, the ability to plan dinner or not get all shook up when the book is missing. And those are the daily fabric kinds of things of life that don't just end in childhood but continue as we go into the workplace or we live as a partner with someone else. And now we're looking at old age as well. And we find that people who are engaged in volunteer work and giving and taking are also more resilient.
Are you suggesting the possibility that if we haven't been terribly resilient for much of our lives, that we've been kind of fragile and reactive, that even as we age, it's possible to become more resilient as we age?
I believe it's true, yes, because what we're finding also with returning veterans, and we're just beginning to learn more about that through some of the VA projects, is that given the proper context and milieu, people can learn strategies that help them be more resilient.
That's really interesting. You also said in your book that resilient children have attributes relative to more vulnerable children. I'm interested in your findings.
Well, what I do actually in the book is summarize some of the national and international research on that topic. And we find that even very young children, they have problem-solving capacities that, if tapped, as we heard earlier, will grow so that the child continues to feel more competent in their environment. And that has to do with not necessarily doing for, but asking the child to contribute to the situation.
Tamar, what can you say about children who are more resilient versus more vulnerable?
Well, I would agree with what Roberta just said, that I think that kids who come to a situation with a sense of competency, that there are things that they can do to impact their situation, that's the beginning. And I think that's cultivated in the opportunity to practice that skill and in being in a setting where flexibility is something that is very visible in the family.
Let's bring on a caller here. We've got Jesse on the line. Jesse, hi. You're on Voices.
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Hi. I'm calling. My question is, I guess I kind of come from the opposite end, the other end of the spectrum. 5 months ago, my brother, my only sibling, was involved in a really freak accident, and the circumstances of it at the time were just, like, horrible. It was just a few days from his 18th birthday, and, like, he had just graduated high school. He had a big scholarship. And for my parents, it's really painful for them to deal with this. But for me, it's different. I actually feel like I'm not having a whole lot of pain from it. I mean, I am. I miss him, and I love him, and I loved him then, and I still do. But I feel like my pain is bearable. And I feel guilty about that sometimes because I feel like I should be feeling worse.
Yeah.
Well, maybe resiliency explains it or something.
Well, let's find out. When did this happen, Jesse?
This happened in the summer. It was July 8th.
So it's very, very recent. And how old are you?
I'm 24.
So it was your younger brother.
Yes.
B, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, what comes to mind is a concept called survivor guilt. And it really is connected to the experience of having someone you love who like for you, is in a situation where you had a terrible accident, or for other children, might be siblings who are ill or impaired, who have grave difficulties. And just the sense that someone they love has been hurt so badly, while they themselves have not been, you know, tends to generate, you know, it's not guilt in the classic sense of doing something wrong. It's an existential sense of, you know, why am I okay and someone I love has been so deeply hurt. It's very hard not to feel bad about that.
I would also bring up and ask you, Roberta, you know, here's Jesse talking about the impact this had on him versus his parents, and even though the same family member died, they really all experienced very different traumas, didn't they?
Yes, each family member is coming from a different window or lens, as we say. And I also think that time is an issue here. I would think that if we talk to you, Jesse, in a year, you'll be at a different place in resolving this. So our thought processes are kind of protective in that sense. And you're probably at a place that's best for you to be without us interfering with them, so to speak.
Right, right. And, you know, it's back to what you said about our natural tendency to heal. And part of that natural tendency to heal is initially anyway, you know, forming scar tissue over where the wound is and a scab. And that's healthy. That's what we need to do in the short run.
And it's coming to a point of acceptance.
Yeah. Yeah. Jesse, I wish you the best. I really do. And I'm terribly sorry for your awful loss.
Thank you very much for the kind words.
Tamar?
I just wanted to add, too, in the context of a family, that I think sometimes we play different roles. And part of what may go on is that while Jesse's parents are in this very raw period of terrible loss, that he may be coming through with his resilience. And when there's an opening at another time, sometimes that's when we can come forward with our feelings. But right now, he may be holding together some for the sake of the other members of the family who aren't coping so well.
And we should say that acute grief is not a sign that there is no resilience there, the absence of resilience. It's not suggestive of that.
Absolutely. I'm very glad that you said that, because I think that actually it would be more detrimental to not experience those very real feelings that, you know, the body needs to integrate and the mind need to integrate those feelings. That's part of the healing process.
I'm also reminded of a man I worked with years ago who lost a child, very similar freak accident. This was his only child. And he said something I hadn't realized. He said, "That child was my future. I mean, this is where, this is what I was working for. This is where my estate was going, this was my vision of my future, and I've lost that. And that's part of what parents lose when they lose a child. And this young man was in the midst of building his future. Both boys were in the midst of building. So it's going to have a tremendous, tremendously different impact for these people in different spots in their lives.
I think, too, if I can just add, that the that part of that healing then is going to be changing that narrative, or finding how that narrative changes through the grieving, so that you're finding a new purpose in your life, because that one, that story no longer is the one that, that fits.
Which sets up the next question, and I wanted to get this to you, Bea, before we have to take another break and say goodbye to Roberta. Tell us about the Transcending Trauma Project.
Well, quickly said, as I mentioned before, we developed the project to look at not just the negative consequences of extreme trauma, but to look at how people cope and adapt. And certainly the Holocaust, being one of the most extreme traumas that can be imagined, you know, is a way to really study rebuilding, not just going on, but literally starting all over again. And so we looked at coping and adaptation, not just the negative consequences. And yes, there are negative consequences. It's not just all the potential for resilience, but people do suffer. But also to understand who survivors were before the Holocaust. Too much of trauma literature begins the story of the survivor after the trauma as if they were born that day and didn't have full lives before they were impacted. So we did extensive interviewing with survivors and children and grandchildren to understand who the survivors were before, what experiences did they have in their families of origin, what were their faith system and belief systems, what did they experience in their communities, what was their attitude towards life, their personalities, in order to understand in their survival and then their patterns of coping and adaptation, what went into that, what qualities in their life experience went into contributing to certain ways of coping, adapting, and rebuilding their lives, and who were more successful and who were less successful.
What's the difference?
And why? People who not could experience positive experiences in their families, could move forward constructively, who could adapt to circumstances, and if not personally experience great happiness, could set up circumstances for their children to experience happiness, versus survivors who were more mired in the past and unable to get past their pain and could not, as I said before, see outside of their own selves and see the needs of others.
I know lots of children, many of Holocaust survivors.
Right.
And some absorb their parents' pain and suffering and feel guilty about any joy they might experience and almost refuse to allow themselves to feel joy out of loyalty to their parents' pain. And others feel nothing but love and admiration for their parents, gratitude for their survival skills, so on and so forth. And some of these people who feel this love and gratitude grow up with parents who are depressed. And mm-hmm. from a clinical viewpoint, well, that's confusing to me. You know, if you grow up with a depressed parent, it's supposed to have an impact.
Right, but you have to look beyond the facts, and you have to look at the quality of relationships, because that it would be impossible to know survivors who didn't have some measure of suffering after their experience. The question is, how much are they oriented? How much can they be oriented to other, to the needs of the family, to the needs of their children, and how much are they caught up in their own selves?
Mm, yeah.
And if they can be oriented to the needs of their children through these qualitative family relationships, which include empathy and affirmation and validation and closeness, then the child can deal with the parent's depression and yet be able to live more fully because they're validated themselves.
Well, your question, how much are we caught up inside of ourselves, really spells the difference between how happy and well-adjusted we are in life in general, too. We've got to take a short break, and we have to say goodbye to Roberta. Thanks so much for joining us, and I appreciate
Thank you
sharing
the
research.
Me.
Roberta Green's chair of the Department of Gerontology, the University of Texas in Austin. She's written Resiliency, an Integrated Approach to Practice, Policy, and Research. I'm joined here in the studio by B. Hollander Goldfein, Director of Postgraduate Training in Marriage and Family Therapy at the Council for Relationships, and she runs the Transcending Trauma Project. Tamar Chansky is a psychologist, director, and founder of the Children's Center for OCD and Anxiety. She's the author of three books on children's anxiety, strategies to help them get through it, and their resilience. We're going to talk more about what parents can do to help foster children who have anxiety. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
The Penn Program for Stress Management supports WHYY and sponsors a three-day event, February 6th through 8th, exploring mindfulness and meditation as tools for teaching and learning. Featuring a public lecture by Jon Kabat-Zinn, the founder of Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, followed by an interview with Dr. Dan Gottlieb of WHYY's Voices in the Family. Full details at pennhealth.com/stress or 215-615-2775.
Next time on Day to Day, Amanda Plo was feeling a little ho-hum about Christmas, so she tried something to snap out of it.
Every one of these letters is addressed to Santa Claus.
You wouldn't mind my red nose?
Merry Christmas!
A mega dose of happy holiday movies.
It could very well depress me, but there's only one way to find out.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about resilience with Dr. B. Hollander Goldfein, who is with the Council for Relationships, and she runs the Transcending Trauma Project. I'm also joined by Dr. Tamar Chansky, who's director and founder of the Children's Center for OCD and Anxiety. Tamar, you know, we talked about making meaning out of one's life and making meaning out of one's trauma. That's hard to do when you're a kid.
That's very true, and I think that patience is really important. That part of what happens is that just as children may feel that whatever they're feeling in the moment is how they're going to be feeling forever, that parents may also, in empathizing with their child's suffering, may feel that way too, and just feel like whatever's going on now, they have to fix, because it's not going to change on its own. And so having that belief that what you're feeling now is temporary and that you can impact the course of it is a crucial piece for how children are going to be able to be more resilient, is parents adopting that mindset.
All of your books have the word anxiety in the title. Is anxiety the opposite of resilience? Or is that the thing that interferes with resilience?
I think that what I try to stress in all the work that I do is this idea that we're always trying to survive, and our minds are always trying to help us survive at any given moment. But sometimes what happens is that our survival mechanism that gets there first all the time exaggerates or magnifies the risk or the negative in a situation, and I call those first thoughts. And that our goal is to not get stuck on our first thoughts and really know that we can have second thoughts, third thoughts, fourth thoughts that are different views, different versions of the story, and so that anxiety doesn't have to be the opposite of resilience unless you get stuck there.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Paula on the line.
Paula,
hi, you're on Voices.
Hi. Yes. I have a question about resilience. It's my personal experience. I was hit by a car 15 years ago, and it was a very bad accident. I was in a coma for a couple of weeks, and when I woke up, the left side of my body was paralyzed. And there came, you know, recovery. And for the first 5 years after that accident, I would say I felt very resilient. I felt I had survived. I could pretty much do anything. And I, you know, got up, was able to walk again, rebuild my life, got a master's degree, got married, had children. And then, my left leg was very spastic. So I had surgery, I had an implant, a baclofen pump, which relaxed the muscles on my leg. And when I woke up from the surgery, something felt different. I felt this fear, overwhelming fear, that I didn't know where it was coming from. And from that day on, for the next 10 years, I've been dealing with this panic attack, you know. And I wondered very much, I consider myself a very resilient person, and this has been really hard. It just makes me think of myself as a completely different person. I'm not sure where resilience starts, and can it just end, you know? That's kind of my question.
Well, let me ask a question before I pass you over to our experts. You said you used to think of yourself as a resilient person. How do you think of yourself now?
Well, it varies.
I'll take this minute's definition.
I'm sorry?
I'll take your definition this minute.
Okay. I think I'm resilient, but I have to work hard at it.
Okay. Well, here's the question. I'll take Paula's question and hand it over to you. She was resilient, certainly, but now sounds like, and we're not allowed to diagnose over the phone, she's developed an anxiety disorder. Does that mean she's not resilient? Tamar?
I wonder what the circumstances were of this surgery, and if there's some answers in there of just what, you know, the degree of control, of certainty, of confidence that the people who did the surgery gave you, and actually what your actual life has been like since the surgery. I have more questions than answers about that.
I'll tell you my experience, Paula. My experience was, for the first 5 years after my accident, which is 29 years ago, I was on a learning curve. I was on the bottom end of a learning curve, learning how to live my new life as a quadriplegic. And after 5, 6, 7 years, the learning curve flattened out, and I developed a pretty severe clinical depression that needed treatment, and it needed quite a bit of treatment over a period of time. I couldn't tolerate medication because of the disability and so on and so forth. But I got treatment. I got good treatment, and I've improved. So I wonder if that's part of what might be going on with you, Paula. I don't know if we have any more.
Right. I would also want to, you know, again, I would want to ask her more questions than say anything. But in this context, I would just remind us all that, you know, we're not just thinking beings and we're not just feeling beings, that there are multiple aspects to being human. And some of our reactions are on a visceral level. They're on a body level. As Paula says, she doesn't understand why this happened because she was resilient before what happened afterwards. So I would want to know what intervention she had, what she experienced afterwards. But we can't ever forget that we also have to work with the body. And that there are ways to do that in therapeutic approaches to help the body release its reactions, its emotional reactions to experiences that are frightening, that present a threat, and integrate that experience within our feelings that we're aware of and our philosophies of life and our beliefs and our attitudes.
Tamar, you talk about something called resilience to go. What is that? And how can I get me some?
Well, I talk about resilience to go as a sort of four-step plan for parents when they encounter their child who is stuck, maybe afraid to try something, having a bad day and being really overwhelmed about it. And so I walk parents through different steps to not go with the overwhelming picture that a child presents us with and feel like we have to solve that, but to really step by step break it down. So I can tell you the steps.
You could summarize them. We're almost out of time. Go on.
Well, empathy first. We rush to solve problems for kids. They really don't want our solutions. They want to be heard. So that's step one. And step two is I call specificizing, which basically means just narrowing down the problem to what was the straw that broke the camel's back. Helping kids then to look at the situation from different perspectives and then mobilizing, figuring out what they want to do to solve the problem.
Kind of re-empowering.
Yes, putting it back with the child.
Because anytime we are traumatized, we lose our sense of power and control. Faith, is that a factor? Faith is often the opposite of anxiety. I'm going to turn that to you, Bea, and ask you if you can give us a brief answer to a big question.
Right. I'm not sure I'm capable of that. I think faith is a very important factor. Faith can be expressed as belief, you know, a religious grounds, or it could be a sense of spirituality. If you look at the resilience literature, the sense of being involved in things bigger than oneself gives meaning to life is part of a faith experience that is very healing.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. It was an interesting and important show.
Yes, thank you, Dan.
My guests have been Dr. Bea Hollander-Goldfein. She's director of the Transcending Trauma Project at the Council for Relationships. I've also been joined by Dr. Tamar Chansky, author of Freeing Your Child from Negative Thinking, Powerful Practical Strategies to Build a Lifetime of Resilience, Flexibility, and Happiness. She's also written three other books. We were also joined earlier by Dr. Roberta Green, author of Resiliency, an Integrated Approach to Practice, Policy, and Research. Well, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org or reach me at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is the executive producer for radio content at WHYY. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced, co-produced by Gita Simons and Alisa Walters. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, the host. Enjoy your week, my friends.